all you need, and just use the mouse. I'll try to give you a 5-minute warning like this, and if we get to 2 minutes, I'll stand up.
Perfect. All right, thanks. Thanks for being at the session, and late in our Seoul S1 agenda anyway. We had so far a number of talks about measurements of water content at small scale. And I think we can make the argument that S1 has really led the charge for making more and more and better measurements at the small scale. The unfortunate reality is that outside of S1, people more and more want measurements at the large scale. So we saw this from the one atmospheric talk from Dr. Kosh. There's a lot of interest in making these measurements that we can use to drive models at the larger scale. And I think that at this point, there's a lot of wishful thinking going on, perhaps, about these measurements at the large scale. We get them, we get some kind of average, and we think that that average has the meaning that we want it to have. So I'm admitting up front that I'm coming into this as a skeptic of large-scale measurements, and I want to look at what are the possible impacts of some effects at the small scale on what we might be seeing with these large-scale measurements. So that's by way of an admission to start with. So to start with a couple of definitions, what is a point scale measurement and what's a large scale measurement? For me, it has to do with the difference between the scale of measurement or the sample volume and the scale of spatial of correlation of the water content. So if your spatial correlation length is large relative to your sample volume, you have a point measurement. If your spatial correlation length is small, you have a large scale measurement. You have averaging going on within there. Obvious downsides of point scale measurements, we are undersampling. So we're only taking a few measurements typically because they're expensive. So we may not capture the range of behaviors, and we may not be able to capture what the actual average behavior is because of our undersampling problem. So this requires some kind of upscaling. Downsides of large scale measurements are that we have to have some kind of trust or some kind of understanding of how these small scale variabilities are being averaged by the measurement in order to use them in our large scale models. And for me, again, this is a personal bias, but conceptually I have a harder time understanding how we go about downsampling an aggregated measurement than upscaling a bunch of point measurements. But I'm open to being schooled on that. So I'm going to look at a very simple example, and I want to make this simple, and it's all theoretical, and it's a silicon experiment, just so that we can understand some of these impacts and start looking at them, and it's a very first-order examination. So I want to imagine that we have this field that's perfectly drained, and we flood irrigate it, so we have this zero ponding condition for a couple of days, and then we let it drain. And our interest might be in actually mapping the average zone water content within this field as a function of time. And we can either do this with a number of small-scale samples, or we can do this with large-scale samples, where the footprint of that sample varies. And we're going to consider essentially three things: the effects of undersampling, specifically on the small-scale measurements, fewer samples; the effects of this nonlinear spatial sensitivity, and Gerard gave a nice image of that, where we are weighting the measured property within the sample volume differently depending upon its location. And then the last thing that I think is overlooked all too commonly, which is a nonlinear calibration effect. Okay, so at any given point, we are all, you know, versed in soil physics. We see this kind of a response. We have a dry condition, start with a uniform negative pressure head, and then we have 2 days of infiltration front followed by drainage internal redistribution. And again, to make things very simple, this is with no evaporation at all. So this is all an internal drainage problem. Now, to try to represent the range of behaviors that we might see, I took the soil textural triangle and split it up by 2% steps in sand, silt, clay. I ran that through the mind of Marcel Schopp, as encapsulated in Rosetta, and then ran those soil hydraulic properties through the mind of Jurka Siminek, encapsulated in Hydrus. So we have these water content profiles, and then I looked at the average water content at about the top 20 centimeters as a function of time. So those light blue lines are 1,326 different soil responses for this same boundary conditions and initial conditions. And then we're going to subsample those. So we'll say, let's say we have 10 soils on our field, and those dark blue lines are the responses of those 10 soils. So then we take these 10 soils and we distribute them randomly with no spatial structure to start with on our field, right? And then if we do that and we look at this through time, we see this kind of water content patterns that evolve. Initial water content distributions, what does it look like at the end of flooding, and then what does it look like after 3 days of drainage? Okay. So the question is, if we were to go out and sample on this field, let's say, for example, we were going to take 9 samples and we use some kind of rational distribution where we break the field into 9 cells and then we randomly place a sensor within each one of those cells. If we were to do this 50 different times, what average water content will we find through time? And just for ease of display, I'm just looking at the variation in the final time's water content. So along the x-axis, I'm increasing the number of samples. So I start out with just having one sensor in the field. And of course, I get the full range of water contents at the end. And as I increase the number of samples and average them across all of those samples, as we would expect, the variation in the average water content starts to decrease. The true water content, the field average water content, is shown in red. And then the green line shows plus or minus 2%, which we might think of as how well we could do with TDR if there was actually any error in those measurements. So what it's showing is that for the structure that we imposed and the process that we looked at, by the time we get up to about 25 samples, we're really capturing, we've reduced the uncertainty or the variation in that mean that we might measure. And any additional samples aren't really changing things that much at that point. So that's one way that we can go about it. We can take small-scale measurements, and we can add more and more of them. And then the other thing that we can do, before I do that, this is showing all of the time histories of water content as a function of time for 25 samples, 50 realizations. So we start to see that the time histories, they vary considerably, but they're all falling within what we might think of as what we could measure with plus or minus 2% accuracy. The other way that we can do this is take a sensor and place it somewhere in the field and then increase its footprint. And then we can compare the size of the footprint to the number of samples, and especially in this random distribution, they should be about the same. And we see that really they essentially are. We have a few more outliers with the local footprint, the large-scale measurement, but for the most part, it's behaving as we might expect. Now, of course, up to this point, there are no surprises in this at all. We have a random field, so the number of samples doesn't matter if they're spatially distributed or if they're all clumped together in a footprint, right? So this is what we should expect to see. And I would contend, again, is that this is what we're often assuming that we see with any large-scale measurement. But we know that any of our indirect measurements are not a perfect linear average of the water content within the footprint. So we can start to look at the impacts of this nonlinearity. And the comparison that I'll make as we add more complexity is we're going to look at the standard deviation of the mean of that water content, so the variation in that water content at the final time, as a function of either the number of samples or the size of the footprint. Right? It's the same difference in this for this realization. So again, we see that by the time we get to about 25, either size of footprint or number of samples, we've reduced the uncertainty or the standard deviation of that to something around the TDR uncertainty. Now, if we think of most sensors that are not satellite-based sensors anyway, which may be somewhat different, but most sensors have a source, and then the power for that source drops off with 1 over distance or 1 over distance squared, and then the sensitivity, the cross-section, the capture cross-section from any point, also decreases with distance. So we end up typically having this kind of nonlinear sensitivity as a function of distance from our instrument. And I'm just showing that here on the right. As a function of the size of the footprint, which I've defined as the point at which the sensitivity is dropped to 1% of that at the instrument, as a function of the size of the instrument, we have this different spatial sensitivity. And going into this, I expected that this nonlinear sensitivity, rather than sort of a step sensitivity or constant sensitivity, would have the impact of effectively reducing the footprint size. So we're actually looking over something that's smaller than we're reporting in terms of a footprint size. And so I was quite surprised to find that this essentially had very, very little impact on the ability to capture the average water content. So even with this highly nonlinear spatial sensitivity, at the small number of measurements, at 4 or 9 measurements, maybe up to 25 measurements, we're starting to see a little bit more standard deviation due to the reduced effective size of the footprint, but it really doesn't have all that much impact. So I thought, well, there must be a problem lurking in there somewhere. So what about the impact of nonlinear calibration? And one of the things that we go out of our way to do as instrument people is that we do our calibrations under homogeneous conditions. And we do that so that we know the relationship between our measured property and our property of interest. So we'll end up with these very nice calibration equations that might have R squareds approaching 1, but they're nonlinear. Well, what's the impact of that? We're measuring something, and we're trying to infer water content from it. So if we think about this, this calibration curve can also be looked at as a sensitivity curve. So if we were to increase the water content from 9% to 10%, we'd have a very small impact on our instrument response. If we increase it from 19% to 20%, we have a much bigger impact. So what that means is that the increase in water content, or the distribution of water content, the response that we would get from that depends on where that water content is. It depends if it's a wet region or a dry region. So we have a non-unique relationship between our measured property and our property of interest, even if we have a perfect calibration relationship. So the question was, what is the impact of this? And again, this is very, very common. It's very strange to find a calibration that is linear. And one of the sort of counterexamples is the relationship between water content and square root of water content and travel time. So for TDR. So that's one of the reasons that TDR has always worked so well, essentially. So what's the impact of this nonlinear calibration? Well, this basically floored me. I had to do this over and over again, because as a true scientist, I wasn't satisfied that my hypothesis was wrong, right? So I kept doing this, and every time I did it, it turned out that there was no impact. It had no impact on the uncertainty of these measurements, which I was absolutely floored, and I didn't know what I was going to say, because I did this yesterday. And so I kept looking, and finally, much to my satisfaction, it struck me that we are getting more and more confident in our measurements, but if we look at the time histories, what we find, and this might be not that clear, so I'll take a second to point it out, this is what happens when we add nonlinear calibration. And the impact is that now the mean doesn't run through the middle of those realizations, right? So if we compare that with what it looks like for the linear calibration over a large footprint or a large number of samples, it doesn't look all that convincing, but if we look at it this way, what we're finding is that the nonlinear calibration ends up with a bias in our measurement, and it's a bias that we can be more and more sure of, right? So we're sort of wrong and strong when we use some of these measurements with nonlinear calibration. The extent of that bias depends on the specific distribution of water content on that field. So this is not something that can be calibrated away. It depends on how much the water content varies within the sample. This is shown for a footprint area of 25, so it's still a fairly small area of the field. It looks identical if you make a measurement that goes across the entire field. So if you have a sample size that is equal to the size of your field, you still have this bias, and you have this unknown and unknowable bias. So in this case, and again, I was interested to hear from Dr. Kosh, you know, at this point, it's an error of 1%, so who cares? It doesn't really make that much difference, perhaps, for what they would like to do. But that's a specific case of a specific water content distribution. And there are a number of things that we haven't included as possible sources of error in this. So I'll hit on a couple of those just before I finish up. So I mentioned at first that we had intentionally no spatial correlation of the soil structure. Now, that is helpful to a large-scale measurement, because essentially what a large-scale measurement is doing is taking all of those distributed measurements and putting them right next to the instrument, right? So rather than being able to take individual measurements and spread them out, we're limited to measure near the instrument. So if we have a larger spatial correlation, that same size measurement goes more and more towards a local measurement, right? It's the ratio of those two. The other issue is there's non-uniform timing of flooding. So again, I chose an intentionally very simple situation where we have about the simplest hydrologic condition that we can. But what if we have a rainstorm in which we have differential precipitation across the field, or we have different timing of precipitation across the field? When we start to interpret that using something like a scaled-up Richards equation, we're going to have what in hydrology we're starting to recognize as this model structural error. We're going to take our average water content, some of which is due to a variation in timing of our boundary conditions, and we're going to try to apply it on the field scale. So again, in this averaging, this upscaling through the instrument, we can lose some of that local scale information that can help us to improve interpretations. The third thing here is this inference of mean travel time. It's just as an example. In the case of that I showed you here, we're after the mean average water content, and we're measuring something that's related to the mean average water content. But if we were to look at something like the flux divided by the water content at any location, which would give us the mean travel time of a solute, essentially, then we're really interested in something that's not being measured. So we're going to end up with a confluence of this error in the water content and an error in the flux based on this upscaling that can lead to, in this case, an underestimation of say, solute breakthrough through the field. And then finally, and this is really a big one, but it was too tricky to try to handle, is if we have non-uniform sensitivity of the measurement with depth. And you hear this very often from any above-ground instrument. They're almost without exception, they're much more sensitive at the surface than they are with depth, because essentially they have to look through that surface soil to see the soil that lies underneath. So again, this average water content that we're seeing is not only some nonlinear weighting with space, it's also a nonlinear weighting with depth. And in the case of nonlinear weighting with depth, we have a different process. We can have drainage or evaporation at the surface that becomes overweighted when we try to scale up these measurements or use these scaled up measurements. So it's the beginning of the story. I admitted that I had some bias coming into it, and I would say at this point that some of the things that I thought were going to be problems, this nonlinear calibration, nonlinear spatial weighting, for some cases, they're actually not as bad as we might think. So we might be able to use these large-scale measurements as if they were equivalent to local-scale measurements. But I think the story still continues, and there's some questions that we'll have to ask when we think about what we're seeing and is it the same thing as what we want to see. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Ty. We have time for some questions, so please raise your hand. And
all right, Steve.
As you move forward, Ty, what would you think would happen if your sensor actually didn't permeate the soil uniformly?
So if you have differential sensitivity with depth, yeah?
Non-uniform permeation of the soil. In other words, it goes in this part, but not that part. It goes in the wetter part.
Yeah,
not
and that's... Yeah, absolutely. That's a whole other issue that we've looked at for a lot of our local measurements, yeah. Is property-dependent spatial sensitivity. In the map sense, one of the advantages of a lot of these remote methods is that the measurement here is not really affected by the measurement there. But this nonlinear weighting and water content-dependent weighting with depth will probably be a big issue, because again, the whole issue here is that we are relying on the instrument, the average instrument response, to still follow the calibration relationship. And anything that pushes off the average of the instrument response from the average of the water content that you're interested in at that location is going to lead to more and more error in there, and probably a bias as well. So, good. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Todd.